As Prime Minister, I want to speak to you simply and plainly about the grave emergency now facing our country.
Once you've waltzed through the 90s and the noughties as well, where do you end up? Back in the 1970s, at least you do on Politics Weekly.
You're listening to Edward Heath conducting the Lambeth Walk, and we're going to be asking whether we're entering a new era of 70s-style political turmoil, minus the platform shoes.
We have two politicos and indeed distinguished historians to help us glance back to the future. Andy Beckett, the G2 writer who's also written When the Lights Went Out, about what really happened to Britain in the 70s, and Politics Weekly regular Anne Perkins, whose books include A Very British Strike.
Andy, do you cringe or do you nod your head in agreement when people say, feels like the 70s?
The kind of book-selling part of me, you know, is absolutely delighted. When I started writing the book 5 or 6 years ago, when we were still in a boom, the 70s seemed incredibly distant. And when it came out, suddenly, you know, things seemed rather kind of, you know, full of dread and foreboding intention. So from the book-selling point of view, yes. But I think there are big differences. I mean, the weakness of the left now compared to the strength of the left in the 70s, for example. It's not an identikit situation. But yeah, there's certainly a lot of similarities.
Go on, there's a quick parallels.
Well, I mean, you've got the Conservatives, obviously, you know, on the verge of power. You've got a kind of Conservative leader who's, you know, seems relatively new, relatively fresh, although perhaps not as fierce as Margaret Thatcher. You've got a Labour government which is kind of battered, which has been dealing with crises non-stop for, it seems like, a long time. You've also got just an atmosphere of uncertainty. I think for a lot of the 90s and the early part of the noughties, Britain politics seemed, you know, a bit dull, a bit placid, at least to me. And suddenly we're in a period where politics seems to be moving very quickly and you don't know what the hell is going to happen next in politics or in the economy or, you know, to the environment or, you know, the presence of terrorism as a daily political consideration. These are all very 70s kind of things which are around.
I wonder whether that you don't know what's going to happen next sense, and particularly in a political context, Andy, is perhaps a sign that governments are going to change pretty quickly. Between 1969 and 1979, we had three changes of government. In the last 31 years, we've only had one. And do you think with economic tough times, we might be in for people just chucking out the governments much more regularly?
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. People of my age, I'm 40, have this assumption that governments change quite slowly because that's what we've known as adults. But yes, absolutely. I think it's entirely possible the Conservatives will win with a small majority and then will be very unpopular quite quickly and may not resolve a lot of the public spending issues in a way that enables them to get re-elected. So yes, we could have, you know, a couple of changes of government in the next 5 years. We could have two elections, as some people have said, you know, in the next year. So absolutely.
And are we heading for governments lurching in and out of opposition within 4 years?
I think one of the things that's really changed between the 70s and now is that we've had two long periods of government, and both governments, and particularly this one, have really developed tools to promote the incumbency factor. There are all sorts of devices which make people know what their MP has done for them.
Communications.
Whole communication business. Plus, you know, the very small group of marginals kind of leaves this great sort of these great acres of untouched sort of so-called safe seats, which is what have really got to change if you're going to get big changes of government.
Although, of course, the expenses thing works the other way from communications allowances, doesn't it? It might mean root the rotters out will be the kind of feeling.
If only the expenses thing had happened closer to an election. I think I think it's kind of lost its impact already.
Aren't we getting a little bit carried away? I mean, yesterday there was long faces at the idea of inflation edging up to 3%. 1975, we were talking about it edging up to 30%, 10 times more. Andy, I mean, I know you've said that it's only the book selling part of you that wants to push these parallels particularly hard, but don't you think that the problems we're facing now are pretty mild compared to those in the 70s?
Certainly some of them are. I mean, you're right, inflation is incredibly low now. I mean, 26% I think was the peak in the mid-70s. But I mean, unemployment now, I mean, although it's stopped going up, at least for the time being, I mean, the unemployment in the 70s was considered catastrophic when it breached a million. You know, I mean, even in the Blair boom, in the best years, it didn't get below a million, or perhaps very briefly. So levels of poverty in the 70s, I don't want to be a kind of 70s romantic, but very low compared to now. Levels of, you know, inequality in the 70s, very low compared to now. So some things in the 70s, you know, the racism, the sexism, the air of kind of fear, you know, those things were not things I would romanticize. But other aspects of British life and British politics in a way were more benign in the worst years of the 70s than they were in the most benign years of the Blair boom. And I think that kind of tells you how much Britain's changed because of Margaret Thatcher, I would argue.
I think one of the parallels that Andy hasn't drawn is that what was happening in the 70s but people didn't see was how hollowed out institutions that we were familiar with for a long period had by then become. I mean, most obviously things like, you know, sort of community organisations, traditional community organisations, churches, that sort of thing, that had once been a very sort of powerful block in social cohesion. Mm. And also, I would argue, I think trade unions were becoming hollowed out in the course of the 70s and changing very dramatically. And I think we've got the same thing here, except the most obvious thing that's hollowed out now is the political party itself.
Well, the unions and the left are in a very different place. I think one thing Andy mentions in his book is this fact that you opened Time Out in the 1970s and there was a, along with cinema listings and theatre, there's a revolution column telling you about communities reclaiming land in Hackney or whatever. It's kind of it's a different feeling now, isn't it? There isn't impetus from the left, is there now, as an old order crumbles?
No, I mean, I think there's a strange kind of weightless feeling to politics now because we've been through a period of intense turmoil when the free market kind of orthodoxies that Thatcher helped to introduce to Britain, you know, they haven't collapsed, but they're under strain. There's a lot of cracks. There's a lot of questions being asked. And yet, where are the alternatives? Clearly, there are some, but there's not a kind of whole vigorous world of left of centre thinking that there was in the 70s. Whereas in the 70s, if you were worried about capitalism collapsing, there was a whole menu of other solutions from sort of Soviet communism right through to mild social democracy, which could kind of step in. Whether they were workable or not is a different question.
But isn't it just that the left needs time out of the strictures of government?
I think that's right. I think that would help, but some of those, you know, new ideas on the left were happening in the 70s when the left was in government. You know, people were having new thoughts, maybe not about economics, but about, you know, the role of women,
right,
about race, you know, and equally, exactly, things like the right to buy. If you like, a kind of soft Thatcherism was beginning to be developed by some people in the Callaghan government in the late 70s, which is lost to history now. But
and why didn't it come out then? What would be the lesson from a dying Callaghan government to a dying Brown government?
I don't want to kind of demonise Callaghan because I think in lots of ways he's a very impressive Prime Minister, but I think he got kind of overconfident and overtired. So having had a couple of years in office with the IMF crisis and so on and dealing very effectively with those crises, I would argue, then from the autumn of 78 through the winter of discontent, I think he made a series of very bad judgments, which were a sort of mixture of sort of overconfidence and, yeah, I think just exhaustion. Mm. So he tried to get the unions to accept very low pay settlement in the winter, which provoked the winter of discontent. He didn't call the election, famously, in the autumn of 78 when he probably should have done. And I think he just made some bad calls. And I think when governments have been through a sort of period of adrenalized kind of crisis management, they then maybe make bad calls. And perhaps there's a few lessons there. Although I'd argue that Brown's crisis management, even at the beginning, was not really up there with Callaghan or with Healey's.
Even though he sort of decided to put £20 billion more into the economy, et cetera, et cetera.
I think he made some good calls, certainly. But I think that the level of kind of discussion and management of the cabinet that went on during the IMF crisis puts Brown's handling of the kind of arguments about public spending now in the shade a little. I think, you know, Callaghan kept all that quiet. He was dealing with some pretty fierce debates within the Labour Party about what should happen to public spending in the 70s, and he managed that quite well, whereas I think Brown arguably is not managing that well now, and that's why it keeps popping out in, you know, interviews that Darling gives and so on, which don't necessarily help what he wants.
And how much is the spectre of the 70s very present in the minds of current Labour politicians?
Well, I think, how could it not be? Mm. Not so much because of what happened in the 70s as what happened after the 70s. The groundwork for which, of course, was all done in the course of the 70s, both in that first period in opposition between 70 and 74, and then very much in the course of 74 to 79, when, you know, whatever Callaghan, or maybe because of what Wilson and Callaghan were doing in government, I mean, you kind of had these two very distinct periods, that first period when Michael Foot and Jack Jones were kind of constructing this brave new world, which was scandalising the political establishment, this way that politicians and trade unionists were deciding on you know, pay levels and pay settlements. And I mean, you should hear what the civil servants at the time thought about that. They were absolutely outraged, but it did deliver this kind of long period of industrial peace, and it also actually significantly improved the pay of the lowest paid, which is a problem that's going to be hugely important in the next few years, and, you know, not going to be resolved because no one's going to be brave enough to tackle it in the way that Jones and Foote tackled it. But all through the 70s, there was this kind of complete breakdown of trust within the Labour Party, which was so completely damaging and began a long process, which, of course, you know, was so visible in the 80s. And I think led really then through the 80s and 90s to this kind of loss of faith in politics, which is the thing that most distinguishes the mood now from the mood in the 70s.
My feeling is that the most specific parallel maybe is that just as the IMF and before that the money markets had given the spooks to Callaghan and Healey and Wilson, now we've got all these whispers from the bond rating agencies, haven't we? And do you think there's a danger that we'll be in a period where whoever the politicians are, they're going to be dancing to financiers' tunes, and then that maybe undermines faith in politics, Andy?
Yes, I think that is right. And I think also the ratings agencies, a lot of people question their methodology. They say that they didn't predict the crash, that the way that they assess, you know, the vulnerability of different economies, you know, differs from agency to agency. Exactly the same way in the mid-70s, Healey started cutting public spending 18 months before the markets noticed. So the markets were saying Britain's going bankrupt, the government's profligate, which is essentially what caused the IMF crisis. And by that point, the moment of danger had passed. Healey was actually behaving pretty austerely by the time the IMF people came in and said, you're spending too much money. And in a way, the big change had already happened, but the markets didn't notice because people that work in markets, I think now, and as in the 70s, are often too busy working the market to really subtly understand what the politicians are doing. And there's a fantastic moment during the IMF crisis where Callaghan makes a famous speech saying, you know, we've got to ditch Keynesianism, we've got to be much tougher, not spend money we don't have. And Peter Jay asks the markets for the Times, you know, what do you think of the speech? And they said, oh, he just said the usual socialist stuff. And then he said, did you hear the speech? And they said, no. And then he told them what they said, and he said, actually, he said exactly what we want him to say. But by that point, they'd marked Sterling down, you know. So I don't want to bash the bankers. Well, perhaps I do. But I think often there's a kind of weird disconnect between the markets. And when there's a left or centre government, they often don't distinguish. And in the 70s, the American government, which was very right-wing, the Ford administration, the remnants of it, again, couldn't distinguish really between Healey's brand of socialism, which was actually not very left-wing, and Wilson's more profligate version. And they couldn't draw the distinction. So they treated, you know, Callaghan and Wilson pretty much the same, which wasn't necessarily fair to Callaghan, I would argue.
And there's a question people ask, is Cameron going to be a Heath or a Thatcher? And the volatility means that he has only so much time and, you know, he doesn't have a mandate or whatever. What would be your feeling?
I can't see him as a Thatcher because I've yet to detect, you know, any kind of sort of strong ideological imperative underlying his political position. I can see him much more likely to be a Heath. But then, I mean, I think Heath was actually an extremely well-motivated politician. And I think he was genuinely appalled at the idea of a million unemployed, which was what was behind his U-turn, not the markets. I can't actually see Cameron being motivated in that kind of way. I can see him much more likely to be vulnerable to, you know, kind of sort of external market crisis or something like that.
I mean, I think Cameron's a much better communicator than Heath was. I mean, that shouldn't be underestimated. I mean, I think Heath
can't play the piano though.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, he's, you know, underrated, as Anne says, but, you know, pretty awful communicator. And I think Cameron is a good communicator, and that will help when they're unpopular.
Yeah, but I think people are very suspicious of good communicators now. I think Blair's rather devalued that currency. I think the unfolding Chilcot process, which is likely to overshadow, you know, a Cameron government's early months, is, you know, I think, okay, it's a different government, but I think it'll just really drive home that, you know, what you see is not what you're getting, and you know, that's a very damaging sense of mistrust in politics and politicians.
One 1970s parallel we might have been drawing is that unemployment was rising then, and it's rising now. Or at least that's the parallel we'd expected to be drawing a few months ago. But yesterday, new figures came out which showed the dole queue edging down on two separate counts. Larry Elliott explains why this is good news for Gordon Brown.
Two pieces of good news, in fact, really. Firstly, obviously, falling unemployment's very good news for the government at this stage. 6 months ago, people were assuming that unemployment would be 3 million by Christmas. In fact, it's stops at just under 2.5 million, is now starting to fall a bit. So that's the first piece of good news. The second piece of good news is, of course, that falling unemployment is good news for public finances, because the less people you've got on the dole queues, the less you're paying out in benefits and council tax and so on. So the government estimates that the fact that the count is 450,000 lower now than the National Audit Office said it would be at the time of the budget will probably save something like £10 billion over the next 5 years. And if, as the Treasury believes, unemployment now starts to fall rather than remaining flat, as the NAO assume, that will probably save something like an extra £7 billion. So that's a sort of total of £17 billion in all. And at a time when the public finances are stretched, to say the least, that's very welcome news for the government.
Andy, why are they not getting the credit for it, or if indeed they aren't getting the credit for it? I should say that I can see on your notepad you've got a list of unemployment figures for different years in the 70s. Why don't you know these off by heart?
Because I wrote my book so long ago, I've completely forgotten everything in it. No, that's not quite true. I think unemployment works in a kind of subtle way politically, and I think often when it's peaked but it's still high, that's quite damaging. And what I was checking out yesterday was what was going on when the Tories did their Labour Isn't Working ad campaign in 78, which was famously damaging to Labour. And at that point, I double-checked, unemployment was actually falling. I mean, it was much lower than it is now anyway, but it had fallen from its sort of mid-70s peak. Yet, in the north of England particularly, where unemployment was very high in the 70s, it did tremendous damage. And Callaghan was thinking about calling an election, obviously, in 78. August 78 was when he was down on his farm in Sussex, thinking about it, looking at all the polls. And that was when Saatchi did their poster campaign with the big snaking dole queue, the huge heavy black type saying Labour isn't working. And that probably, no one really knows definitively, the jolt that gave to Labour and the controversy that went on around that poster during the silly season when there wasn't much else to write about was one of the main factors in the election not happening. So unemployment, if it's still high and it's been hanging around a lot, in particular towns, in particular parts of the country, can damage a government even when the headline figures appear to be improving. And I think that's something economists, often based in London, you know, maybe haven't been jobless themselves, don't perhaps give full credence to.
I think there's something. I'm guessing here because I haven't looked it up, but I think there's probably something quite. You have to kind of sort of dig down to uncover this. Speaking as somebody who kind of started work in the 70s, I mean, I can remember it just was the most dominant political thing. It was the one thing that really, really mattered, unemployment. And it's for the rest of my sort of journalistic life, I've been continually astonished at how little impact it really has. And one of the things that happened this week that I think's very interesting is an attempt by individual cities to say, you know, okay, down in the south, there may still be people who are worried they may lose their jobs, but not so much. But look how much some individual cities are hurting, and I think that's the way for people to understand it, and that's where it might have an impact that we perhaps wouldn't anticipate from.
But difficult impact to amplify when this is a completely separate point. But when you have regional newspapers, local newspapers dying, that there's you have a sort of concentration of a narrative in the centre.
It makes it. That's going to be one of the sort of interesting footnotes of this next election.
Although I noticed that unemployment currently in London is still going up and is very high. I think it's the highest in the country apart from the West Midlands. And I think it's interesting the way London is covered or not covered. Mm. I think poverty in London is always undercovered massively by the media. And that's a sign of that. You know, when did you last read a story about unemployment in London? It's always, you know, manufacturing towns and all the rest of it. And if I was unemployed in London, I'd feel that was, you know, a bit of a shame, really, to put it mildly.
But, and I wonder, I mean, in London, I think it's often more transient unemployment than in the North and the Midlands. And it's the Midlands where this election's going to be decided. That's where there's the greatest concentration of key seats. You've said unemployment might prove very important there. What's hard to call, though, is it was rocketing up. That would have been bad for Gordon Brown. Now it's plateaued, but plateaued at a high level. Do you think people will cling to Nurse for fear of something worse in those places? Or do you think they'll still blame him?
And I mean, the whole unemployment story from this recession has been interesting, hasn't it? And I've seen it argued that that's because the workforce is very different now, and partly because it's better educated and better equipped, and partly also because of the sacrifices people have made to stay in work. You know, when in the Midlands, it's industry that's losing people, and it's the rump of Britain's manufacturing history that's going. I mean, I can't call it, but I can't believe that they're going to have any more faith. I don't know. I think they're much more likely to want to, you know, go with the new face than stick with the old one.
Going back to Anne's point about cities, just briefly, my favourite 70s revisionist fact is that Boys in the Black Stuff, Alan Bleasdale's famous play about and TV series about unemployment in Liverpool, was actually, he started writing it in 1977, and it was essentially about unemployment under Callaghan. And then it was obviously broadcast on TV in 82 and was seen as a condemnation of Thatcher, and he did toughen it up. But I wonder now whether there's someone sitting around writing a furious play about unemployment in Wigan or in Liverpool, and then when Cameron's Prime Minister, you know, heaven forbid,
yeah, seen nothing
it
yet.
Will then get a revamp and will be even fiercer.
Well, that is it. It's ground control to Major Tom, Tom Clark.
Well, thank you, Ziggy, from myself and you. It's all for this week. Thank you to Andy Beckett and Anne Perkins for joining us.
And to Francesca Panetta and Ben Walker for producing.
We'll be back next week, but until then,
goodbye.